Okay, sirrah, sirrah, we're off to Stevenage, which is, as you're listening to this now, not quite as fresh news as it is as we record this podcast at 7:30 on Monday, but it's breaking news, and by the time you're listening to this, perhaps it's a Thursday morning and it's completely old news. But nonetheless, Stevenage is in the third round of the FA Cup for the 2017-2018 season for Reading, and welcome to the 146th episode of the Tile STEM podcast. We're almost to the 150th, which has a name. What's the name for 150th thing? Is it century for 100?
Yeah.
Century and a half? There's a word for that, isn't there?
I don't know it.
Bi-duocentennial, possibly. We need to know this because the 150th anniversary of Reading Football Club is coming up.
Oh,
I hope. Not too distant future.
I'm hoping that they're not going to coincide because that means I'd have taken a long time to get the next three podcast episodes out. But nonetheless, in the meantime, we'll have 146 then. And this is the Tile STEM podcast. I am Mark May, as per usual, and I'm joined by two guests this week. First, it is the author of The Legend of Robin Friday and among other books, and he's joining us to have a chat about that particular book this evening. And it's Roger Titford. How's it going, mate?
Good evening, Mark. Going well.
Excellent. And Steve Curtis, aka Royal Hoops, is also joining us this evening.
Evening.
So, Stevenage, quick word before we crack on. Happy?
Winnable. So, yes, I'm happy.
Very happy. We owe them one. The score is 1-1 in FA Cup ties this century with them.
Yeah, Stevenage claimed a 1-0 win at the Medeski Stadium 2012. I'm going to pull that out and say it was 2012. And we beat them 2-1 a few years before that. We're just talking off air. Shane Long with a very late goal at Stevenage to secure or to beat that upset, basically. So Stevenage it is. And just a couple of notes before we crack on then, as we look back to last weekend's win over Sunderland. Any Patreon campaign is still up and running. It's always up and running for this Tile STEM podcast. Anyone who's thinking of getting involved, please do. We can always do those extra funds because we're still drinking water in these podcasts. And let's be fair, we should be drinking, Prosecco by this stage. Certainly for 150th.
By then we need Prosecco on tap.
And speaking of which, it will be the Christmas podcast in a couple of weeks where we go through our award ceremony and everything like that. We always throw the net out to anyone who just wants to pop along and say hello. I know a few of you have done it beforehand and I will be doing that. But first, we need a location and probably a date as well. If anyone listening to this knows of a great location, knows of a really good, maybe they own a local bar or some sort of venue, wants to throw us a line, please do that at thetilestend@gmail.com. Always open to suggestions. And of course, anyone who wants to come along as well, get in touch on the Gmail or the Twitter as well and Facebook. So we'll be cracking on then into last weekend's win over Sunderland in the recap, and that will be now.
View from the Tilehurst End. Recapping this week's championship action.
So this was the definition of a banana skin game, going away to Sunderland when they haven't won at home in basically as long as I can remember, certainly. And we come away with a 3-1 win. It's pretty hard to have any complaints over that. Callum McManaman getting sent off in first half stoppage time, having handled the ball into the net. And then in the second half, Dave Edwards pops up with a nice goal and two for Mo Barrow. Roger, what would you say about this game? Would you say that this is the type of thing that we can really get happy about? Or are Sunderland the type of team that actually beating them isn't that important for us these days?
On form, we should have won that. In terms of omens and so on, I quite agree with you. Absolute banana skin. I thought we were going to go down 4-1. They've got a new manager, his first home game. They haven't won for 20 home games. So I thought, here goes the Chris Coleman revolution at our expense. But no, thanks to the young lad punching the ball into our net and getting himself sent off, we had a very easy journey out of it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a bit of an odd one to have that. I watched the replay and, I mean, I just think he has handled it in his back of the net. It's kind of blatant. Would you agree, Steve?
Yeah. I watched it on the replay as well just to make sure. And it was definitely...
Yeah, it's nice to avoid controversy, isn't it? And as I say, Edwards and Mo Bauer getting the two goals. The man, I must admit, I wasn't in Sunderland this weekend, but I was watching the highlights. And the man who really impressed me in the highlights was Jan Kermigant. His impact on that game, and in particular the goals, would you say that maybe that's the type of Jan Kermigant performance we want to be seeing all the time now?
Yeah, he's definitely got that touch of class, and you can really see it just in the short highlights we have access to, and we see, you can really see he's got that link-up play, that quality on the ball where he sees things that other striking options don't really have, and he's happy to drop deep and link play. And I think he brings the best out of those wingers either side of him, because he drops deep and then plays those balls round the corner.
Would you say for Kermagant that the two wingers alongside him last year, McCleary and Behrens, probably weren't as attuned to his style of play that maybe Aluko and Barrow are?
I think Aluko and Barrow are better players. I don't know about being attuned, because Kermagant, I think, is just getting back in, getting his touch back. He's slowly getting back to the form he had at the end of last season. And it's really important for us to have somebody with his presence in the middle of the attack, because it's been a hole there for, you know, quite a bit of the season so far.
Yeah, Stam's been scrounging around trying to find a viable alternative, hasn't he? He even went as far as Sam Smith, who he clearly doesn't rate at the moment.
Sam Smith, who did come on, I think it's the Middlesbrough game he actually started, and yeah, they thought he played quite well, but he's gone the way of Omar Richards, and just that's it since, isn't it?
Yeah.
One start and you're out. Well, I mean, this is the kind of important thing with Stam, isn't it? We've been talking for a while now about, does he know his best team? Does it look like he's found his best team now? And, you know, Gunter at left-back, Bakuna at right-back wasn't the team we thought he'd be picking, would it?
No, but we still don't know what his best team is yet, because he's still short on injuries. Abita, I think he's still a decent shout at left-back. John Swift, still a decent shout in midfield. I don't think we really know yet. And I think, actually, in the modern age and squad rotation, it's pretty hard to ever get a settled 11 for half a dozen games now.
Yeah, I mean, normally you settle on a spine of a team and then rotate around the spine. I do wonder, I mean, I know at the moment Bakuna at right back and Gunter at left back is the most balanced, because I guess Gunter has that presence down the flank, which Blackett, for example, doesn't have.
Right.
But, you know, if Abita was fit, would Bakuna be playing right back, and would Gunter be playing left back? Probably not.
Yeah, that's the question. If Abita was fit, I'll ask it now. Do you think that it'd be Gunter at right back or Bakuna at right back?
Probably Gunter.
I think it would be Gunter, which is surprising me, because Bakuna in the last month and a half has probably been the player I've been impressed with most.
But Bakuna might be in the Joey role.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it?
Strange thing about Joey is that he is playing, in my mind, a bit better now. Fewer of the mistakes, fewer of the sort of horrendous possible red card moments. A
couple of banging goals as well.
Yeah, well, this is the thing with Van der Belt. I've said it about Gunter a few times, is that the less he has to do and the more focused his role is, I feel the better he is for it, you know?
Yeah, and I think he's definitely helped by having someone like Edwards, kind of, not alongside him, but, you know, helping him out, because Edwards is there as a kind of a stable option. He kind of knows his job, and he does what he's expected as well, and he helps out defensively more than other options that might be in midfield with him.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to pick up from this game, I mean, in terms of talking points, it's actually a little bit dry in terms of, well, you know, the red card, we all agree. Goals, good goals, we all agree. Crack on then. But one of the things that was another positive note was, I thought, it was 568 away fans is a really decent total for Reading to have taken to Sunderland. There's something about, I don't know if it's just Reading fans, I don't know if you guys can enlighten me on this, but it does feel like the longest away trip of the season always gets a decent following, just for those fans who want to, you know, it's like a challenge, like a coming of age thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's true. I also think that it's a ground we haven't played at for a while. That makes a difference. There's always a novelty value in going to a ground that you've not been to before. Star took two coaches for that, which I thought was pretty good. That's about 100 people. It's a good ground to look at, apparently.
It is an impressive ground, I hear, and it's one of the highest capacity stadiums in the country, and you might not get much of a chance to visit there for a while. If Sunderland keep this up, they'll be plummeting.
Well, yeah, maybe that's our last ever trip to the Stadium of Light. Imagine.
We'll go up, they'll go down.
Yeah, never see them again. I'll throw some stats at you then before we move on to the real reason that Roger's here then. Four unbeaten, we're 14th now, 10 points clear of relegation, 9 points behind the playoffs. And the thing that I find interesting is that the teams we're surrounded by at the moment are Fulham, Norwich and Sheffield Wednesday. Is that a good thing? Is that a good sign that we're actually in the right place? Or is it a sign that the Championship this year isn't following the sort of normal law of things?
there isn't a normal law of things in the championship.
There is the rule. There are no rules.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of league where you can make all the predictions you want at the start of the season, but by this point, every season is never going the way you expect it to. You know, Sheffield United being right up there, you don't expect that. Wolves doing as well as they are, you don't expect that. Sunderland, I'm sure a lot of people probably thought they'd not be up there, but they wouldn't be in the relegation zone with the squad they've got. It's just the league is absolutely crazy. And actually, looking at those teams, you know, Fulham, Sheffield Wednesday, Norwich, you kind of probably predicted they'd be in the top half near
the title. Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. So, yeah, especially Fulham, who's a team that I'm really surprised have dropped off this year.
It's the Aluko effect. They lose Aluko. They're gone.
But you do get workaday teams that make their way up the table, like Preston, like Ipswich, like Sheffield United. They didn't surprise me because there's a lot of momentum from their promotion last season. We're keeping company with the kind of teams we'd expect to be, but we'd all expect to be about 6 and 8 places higher up the table. What we've got in terms of stats to do to make the playoffs is play at automatic promotion form for the rest of the season, the next 26 games. The target is 75 points roughly.
Yeah, which means we effectively need about 2 points per game for the rest of the season.
We need 49, 50 points out of 26 games. So it's kind of not quite title, but automatic promotion standard to make the playoffs.
Is it too early for us to be saying playoffs? Or obviously the natural optimism in the championship is to say playoffs. Is it still, you know, is there enough time? Like, what's your general sense of the playoffs at the moment?
My sense of this team is that they could win 8 games on the bounce, say, and that really does transform things. You know, Reading teams in the middle of the season, they've done it quite a few times before.
Yeah.
Win 8 to 10 games in a row.
Yeah. Do you know what? I think for me at this point, it would be amazing to get to the playoffs, but I'm not pinning my hopes on it. I think given the start we've had and the amount of turnover in the squad in the summer, I think upper mid-table would be quite nice.
Well, with that cup draw, maybe we should focus on the cup.
We need
a trophy.
Yeah, it's about time, isn't it, really? We got to just a final would be nice that we didn't lose. I just think that it's nice to sort of round off this chat. I just think that it's nice that we're able to have this conversation as opposed to, you know, the questions in the mailbag about 4 or 5 weeks ago were, is the season a write-off? Are we going to be in a relegation battle? At the moment, it's are we going to be in a playoff battle? So that's it's a nice thing to look forward to. And obviously, we've got the Cardiff game next Monday, which we'll preview in a bit. But for now, we'll move on to a bit of a pub chat on a man called Robin Friday.
The Tarlhurst End Podcast. Read the blog on thetarlhurstend.com.
So there's one phrase when it comes to a man like Robin Friday, and in particular, the Reading legend that he is, and certainly icon, I think might even be the best word to describe this this player, Roger. And that is, the greatest footballer you've never seen is the one that always comes back to memory and the one that everyone knows from that particular book. But you've come out with your own piece of work on Robin Friday, The Legend of Robin Friday, which was released a number of years ago now. It was about 2010 that it was released as a sort of online offering, and you've re-released it now as a physical hard copy book, which is available in
Waterstones in Reading, at the Megastore or at the Starbase. And I'll be doing a signing before the Cardiff game at the Megastore on Monday the 11th of December.
Excellent. So why did you decide to produce this as a hard copy, and why now?
It was a response to a number of requests I've had from people, some not very computer literate, and some who found to their horror that the digital version actually expires after 12 months.
So you effectively rent it.
You effectively rent it or lease it or whatever, which I didn't really know and understand when we first did it that way. It was a bit of an experiment all round. So, it disappeared. People wanted to see it, and I thought, well, why not? Bring it out. And I have been waiting for an excuse to bring it out, which would have been the film about Robin Friday that has made its way towards Hollywood, but doesn't show any sign of getting out the other side of Hollywood. So we've pursued that, said, what's happening? But I don't think there's any movement on it for about 2.5 years now, and no response to our inquiries about what was happening with it. So I suspect that the film script has been around longer than Robin's own playing career now.
outliving the legend.
Which lasted 4 years, and I think the script and this proposal have been around for slightly longer than that. So I'm not holding my breath that the film will ever come out. Therefore, I thought, well, let's get it out.
Yeah, well, I was gonna, before you came out, I was thinking of having a little Google and everything, and there's kind of the initial the people who maybe were starring in it as the Robin Friday film, and then honestly there's absolutely no news on it whatsoever, which is quite interesting. I mean, if anyone is out there and knows anything, then please do get in touch, because I mean the Tarlist then has a YouTube channel, and you know, we've got some very basic filming equipment. We just need a bloke with floppy long hair, and then we can crack on and make a movie. We've got the perfect researcher here, and so tell us a bit about what the book goes into, sort of give us the sort of the blurb selling point then, because I'm very interested by the cover. It says, "Warning: contains material unsuitable for children or aspiring young footballers."
Well, that's my main outlet is going to be the Megastore, and I don't want irate parents of Oliver and Tamsin saying the swearing in this. You're a family club, so there's the warning on the front. There's not much swearing, and it's very necessary as part of the Robin Friday legend. The book is about the legend rather than the man. There's no point trying to duplicate the book written by Paul McGuigan of Oasis and Paulo Hewitt called The Greatest Footballer You Never Saw, which was effectively the way of branding Robin Friday for posterity. But we as Reading fans and also Cardiff fans can take a different view, because we did see him if we were lucky enough to be around at that time. And this study of the legend is about how it's evolved, why it's come to mean so much to so many people right around Europe, because you can find YouTube videos about the story of Robin Friday in Italian, in Spanish. You can find a number of music tracks made even since the digital version of this appeared by various bands. So I thought it's a really interesting question. Here's a lower division footballer who won pretty much nothing in 150-odd games, and yet he's still celebrated around the place in this way. Why is that, and what does it tell us about the football culture we live in today that can happen? So those are the two kind of questions that the book really goes into. And the third thing that the book does is to try and show people who never saw Robin Friday play bit of what he was like. There is virtually no television footage of Robin in action. You know, it amounts to about 2 or 3 minutes. But using the resources and the archives of the two local newspapers, I've got together a collection of really good, I think, photographs that show you Robin in action in all his different guises and styles.
Yeah, well, I'd say the having flicked through it just before we started recording, the sort of the graphic sort of looking at Robin himself, but looking at the fans and his teammates around him. I think it's quite fascinating to see, in particular on the cover image, just what, you know, Reading Football Club looked like then, which isn't necessarily something we know too much about now. And you say about going through newspaper archives, was there a lot of maybe talking to people and gathering sort of secondary sources via people's memories and that sort of recollections for this book?
It's mainly a collection of things that I've put together over time, some desk research. There have been a couple of, if you like, homemade movies made about Robin Friday with interviews with people he played with and people who knew him personally in the town at the time. So I haven't done a great deal of personal interviews other than with one of his wives and a couple of people who've seen him play at Cardiff.
I'll open this up to Steve as well. Would you say that every club maybe has or needs a Robin Friday? Is it sort of intrinsic? Is it important for us to, obviously it's a bit of a bygone era in a sense, as to connect with it and to have a club history, particularly Reading, which is, you know, as we know, his in terms of history, perhaps struggles to really generate an idea of what it was like in decades gone by?
I think every club, every institution has to have a kind of naughtiest boy in the class. Yeah, sort of person. Yeah. So if it wasn't Robin Friday, it might be Billy Whitehurst or Royston Drenthe or kind of whoever. But I don't.
Or Anton Zingavich.
You said his name. You're not allowed to say his name.
Yeah, so I'll get the bleep out.
I mean, everyone loves a daredevil in retrospect, not necessarily at the time. Diego Maradona, 1986, cheat. 1994, doper, on drugs during the World Cup. 2017, guest of honour, pulling the tickets out. So, yeah, we'd love a daredevil in retrospect.
How do you feel on that, Steve? Would you say that this is... I mean, could you imagine maybe Reading would be much worse off if it didn't have Robin Friday as someone to go back to and into that era and to, you know, idolise, as it were?
Well, it's a piece of history that we cling to and hold up as, you know, something that is very much a badge of honour. You know, we had Robin Friday and he was at his best with us and all this kind of thing. And if we didn't have that, I'm not sure what we would have. You know, if it was something like Royston Drenthe, that would be absolutely horrendous. So I think every club, if they haven't had someone like a Robin Friday, they will make one for themselves. So, yeah, I think every club will make one somehow.
We'll always find a way.
Yeah, they'll find a way to create a bad boy image, you know.
The point about Robin, it was that he was not just a bad boy. He was a brilliant footballer who engaged the supporters, led from centre forward the first Reading team to be promoted for 50 years, and really did put hundreds, if not thousands, of people on the gate just to come and watch his antics and his skills and his dribbling and his shooting.
Yeah, we were talking off air about how obviously now we have these ways of remembering these sort of players, and perhaps there are a lot of stories out there, and obviously you've spent a lot of time, Roger, in terms of researching those stories. In the immediate aftermath of Robin Friday, you know, retiring, would you say that it was something that was remembered by the club and the fans so soon after, in the late 70s and the 80s? Was it something that fans did say, oh, maybe if we had that player back? Or was it kind of a more of a thing that he got forgotten quite quickly after he left, and then later on in perhaps the 90s and the noughties, his memory came back?
He was never forgotten, but he wasn't elevated for quite some time afterwards. There was a thought that he might come back and play for Brentford in the very late 70s, but I think he trained with them once or twice. Nothing came of that. But there wasn't the media, there wasn't the fan-driven media around at that period after he retired. And he was still alive. So there isn't a closure to that story. He died in 1990. There was a low interest in football in the early 1980s. You know, you'd be lucky if you get a crowd of 3,000 at 5,000 at Reading. I think we went for 6 years without getting a crowd of over 10,000 from the late 70s to the mid 80s. So low interest, low coverage, a few bits on the back of the Evening Post, no live radio, no fanzines, no internet. All of those things came together from his death in 1990. The first book I brought out was the thing I wrote with Eamon Dunphy about the team that Robin Friday played in and won promotion in 1976. And I come from a, if you like, fanzine background, which enabled me to, you know, write that and get on board with Eamon Dunphy. And it wasn't until, as you say, the 1990s that the various forms of media culture through music, the Super Furry Animals, through T-shirts, through fanzines, that this legend began to coalesce. But you're quite right, not much was said in the mid-1990s. A, because there weren't that many people supporting Reading, and B, because Ian Branfoot's team was doing some tremendous things at the time.
You mentioned about him not being elevated immediately. Would you say the moment he began his ascent was at his death, or was there something else that triggered it?
What triggered it, what was the giant leap forward, in a sense, was the Oasis book, The Greatest Footballer You Never Saw. That broke through into being a national thing. That came on as the book goes into quite some detail about explaining what all the individual steps were. There were people talking about Robin Friday and the New Musical Express for, you know, 2 or 3 years before that. But it was 1997 when that book came out, and that came out in the whole lads culture era, you know, Skinner and Baddiel, men behaving badly, lads magazines loaded, you know, all that sort of thing.
Really fitted the narrative then.
Yeah, fitted the moment. And I think at that point, we were just getting into the, we're all nice season ticket holders and it's the Premier League and, you know, we're in all-seater stadium and people going, well, come on, you know, let's have a bit of grit somewhere.
Yeah, I was... You mentioned the sort of modern era now. I do wonder, and what your both your thoughts are on this, as to how might football react to someone like Robin Friday now? I'm not saying necessarily, you know, what type of iPhone would he have. I'm saying if he was the same person, but now, who was in the pubs and chatting to the fans, and then all the other sort of stories you hear and that you go into detail about in the book. How do you imagine that might unfold now?
Do you know what? You get hear loads of stories about young footballers that don't have the right attitude or don't have the right application, and they don't ever really make it nowadays. So you kind of wonder whether someone like Robin Friday, whether he'd actually get the chance to be on the pitch and represent a club. You know, I think, might be wrong, Roger will correct me if I am, but in those days, the standards of professionalism weren't as high. And so I think it was kind of, you know, he's not the best professional, but he's very good. So we'll put him on the pitch and he'll score goals and carry us, you know. Whereas nowadays, you know, we've mentioned his name already a couple of times, but Royce Ndrenthe, he could be a very good footballer, but his off the pitch style was really bad and he never really got given much of a chance. As soon as his performances dipped, that was it, he was gone. So, yeah, that's... I guess.
I think you got that right, Steve. As a personality, Robin couldn't exist in today's game. I put a fair bit in the book about what life in general was like in 1976, which was his peak year. And it was so much more free and easy. Football was lower in status in the national psyche. You know, you could do rotten things and get away with it because, no, you know, you weren't on the media's radar so much. And you know, Reading Football Club was fourth division, was pretty low status. So as a personality, he wouldn't have worked. As a player, question is, could he have been coached to today's levels of fitness and tactical awareness? Would he have wanted it? You know, he had his chances at Chelsea and at QPR before he came to Reading through the amateur game or the Isthmian League game. No, it would be very difficult for people and personalities with that level to come through now. Fourth division football, you know, there wasn't that big a gap between what you saw and what you could do yourself. I used to play with guys who played with the guys who played for Reading, you know, I was a nothing footballer, but I mean, you know, I could see the steps that led up to that, and I could stand there, you know, watching Gary Peters from fullback cross the ball into the Tylehurst end time and time again, think, I can cross a ball better than that.
It wasn't so unattainable.
I mean, Gary Peters could do all the other football skills better than I could probably, but the point was I really did feel, you know, that. Whereas now, the sheer amount of ball skill that pretty much anybody who's on a football field at championship level has is astounding compared with what it was 40 years ago.
Well, we'll move on. I just want to ask you about the star, of course, and the last year's Reading FC, your previous book. Is there anything else you want to add before we move away from Robin Friday then on the book itself and in general, more unique selling points perhaps?
No, I think I've said what it's about. I hope people enjoy it. It's a slim volume, but I think it's got some good nuggets in it, and I think it will be quite pleasing in terms of as a read and the pictures in it.
Excellent. Well, we'll have the on both the Podbean and the Tarleton website, we'll have a link to make sure people know where to get and have some directions and all the stuff with the signing and everything to make sure you know where to go and how to get the book, The Legend of Robin Friday, which is out now. And your previous book, which you came on about a year ago to talk about, I just wanted to have a quick word about the lost years of Reading FC, mainly because I'm reading it myself at the moment.
Good man.
So it's kind of selfish at the moment. It's completely coincidental with Roger's here. He didn't hand over a copy as he walked through the door to some sort of entrance fee. I think, I mean, have... how do you look back on that a year on with it having come out, and maybe any sort of thoughts you've had afterwards? And also, what other periods of the club's history do you think might be worth looking into?
Okay. Well, I've been very pleased with the response. People have got some of the jokes in there, which is good. I'm having to reprint it because it's a small batch exercise. A few people have devoured it whole in one go, which is nice because it is a very chunky book at about 400 pages. But more are kind of savouring it at a sort of chapter a day. And I had some correspondence with, I think it was the chairman of Maidenhead United, because there's quite a bit about Maidenhead.
Yeah, Marlow
and all the other local clubs in there. Who'd, you know, get in touch by email after each chapter and say, what's this about Maidenhead? What's that about Maidenhead? And so on. And it's, you know, I'm just sort of pleased with the way people have got into to that aspect of reading it, because there's a sort of nice, easy rhythm and flow to it. The other thing is that I'm pleased with is that it is changing the club history in small ways. You know, we have found a new Welsh international for the club, accredited now by the FA of Wales. We sorted out the myth about Reading playing at Coley Rec, the myth of various mergers that are in the conventional history but didn't really happen. These kinds of things are getting, you know, noted on the actual Reading Football Club's own website. And you talk about other periods that one might look at. The other day we had stuff about the 6,000th league goal that Reading has scored.
Oh, yeah.
Who was that? Again?
Is it John Swift against Forest, I think?
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds like
John
it, I don't
Swift,
know.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. So all that is based on this perception that real football for Reading only started in 1920 when the club joined the Football League. And the Lost Years is an attempt to say, no, that's not right. And there's another period after the Lost Years, which finishes around 1900, where we're in the Southern League. And I want to say to all the people who think Reading is a tin pot club with no history, that actually we did have quite an interesting, good history before we got in the Football League. You know, we had international players, England international players played for us when we were in the Southern League. We could borrow the equivalent of Wayne Rooney to play in big cup ties for us. We toured Italy. You know, the teams we played against toured Argentina and Brazil, you know, before the First World War. We staged an FA Cup semi-final at Elm Park. You know, there's quite a lot going on there before we actually get into the league. So, you know, when you say, oh, you've got 6,000 league goals, it's a bit of a shame to dismiss the, I don't know, 1,000 or 1,500 we got, you know, in the Southern League, because we were beating proper First Division clubs when we were in that league, which we didn't for quite a long chunks of our history.
Yeah, well, it's certainly be interesting. I mean, in terms of how you would research those sort of periods, it is the newspaper coverage. And as we were talking about in the Robin Friday thing, the level of coverage for Reading FC between 1880 and 1980 probably really didn't grow that much, certainly not as much as exponentially that it's grown now with, you know, this sort of podcast, this sort of website.
There was, to be fair, there was a lot, and part of the reason why football boomed in the 1890s was there was a huge media explosion of all kinds of football newspapers. So you could go into a newsagent and get about half a dozen different football papers on a Monday morning. So for the person who won't be me, who's going to be doing the bit, you know, between 1895 and when we joined the Football League, there's a lot more material to go at in terms of newspaper articles and so on, though not a lot else, obviously.
Let's talk Star then, to round off this this chat before we go into the mailbag. What is the position of Star in general of Reading FC at the moment? What sort of communication is being had with the club? How's your sort of viewpoint on how that's going at the moment?
Well, we're in a new era because we've got a new chairman, Ian Maynard, who's taken over from Paul Ellix, who did a splendid job for 5 years. So he's freshly installed as of September. We're also now dealing with a new chief executive at Reading Football Club, who is Ron Gourlay, who's taking a very hands-on approach to fan engagement issues and so on. So we're really at the start of a new and possibly more kind of intense relationship there. The club have a very strong desire to fill the stadium, and to do that they need to get a lot of people on side after what they themselves will now admit has been, you know, 3 or 4 years where the stuff hasn't been great.
Well, we've sort of chugged along, is how I sort of describe it.
Yes.
Because it was Tiger, one of the Thai owners, Tiger, who was doing a lot of the fan engagement. And then he has left completely now and has moved on to, I think he's gone to Oxford or something he's gone to. And we've got Juan Gorlay now. What was Starr's sort of communication as to what the club has said about that period? What changed? Was there any sort of hellos and goodbyes, or was it just kind of pretending as if business as usual occurred?
No, the Tiger was the only one of the Thais that we had any kind of dialogue with, really. He was really interested in football. So I don't know why he's gone to Oxford, but... I'm sorry.
He's fine, he's left now, he can say what we want.
Apologies. They went fairly quickly, I think. And the belief is that we have a new, more kind of stable and coordinated era. If you think back to the Thais, you've got a consortium of three people. I'm not sure how well they knew each other before they ended up in the consortium that owned Reading. But you have three people, which is unusual these days to run a football club. It's usually a one man's vision. Mm. Tiger tried to grasp that, but maybe the money wasn't there for what they needed to do. But now we're assured that the backing is solid and they want to get on with things slowly but surely. So Bearwood is happening, a lot of investment going in that. Keep the academy status, slowly build up the club on the pitch and get the stadium as full as they can. So prices, you know, more flexible than they used to be.
Yeah, Steve, I mean, we've talked a bit on the Silas Centre about what Juan Gorlay has, sort of his impact on the club in terms of, I think, we've all talked about how the contracts that have been handed to players has changed. Do you feel like there's a different message coming out of the club now to what there has been under previous regimes, or is it kind of, from a fan level, maybe a bit harder to perceive that sort of thing?
I think the one thing we can really go off is the incentives for fans, you know, to go to things. So this, was it Burton, was £5?
Yeah, the 23rd of December game, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's coming up. You have more Star coaches, which is, I'm not sure if that's the club, but I'm sure...
No, but there were the free coaches that went to Sheffield.
Yeah, free coaches to Sheffield. And you, like, there's more pricing incentives coming out, which is obviously them trying their best to get more fans in the stadium. And, you know, they've asked and tried to encourage people to tell them how to improve the atmosphere and all this kind of thing. So they're clearly engaging or trying to engage with people. And, I, you know, we've said on here before that if people want the atmosphere to improve, someone somewhere has to pick it up and run with it and really get people backing them and going for it themselves. You know, the club can do as much as they can try, but really the atmosphere is only going to improve if fans do it themselves and try and go for it themselves.
Yeah, the club are aware of that. You know, the club can overkill on these things. Mm. You know, the moment they do clappers or rumble sticks or whatever, people go, oh no, not that again. So you're right, it has to be fan led and there are people taking initiatives. We at Star are very happy to help people, to advise them things we've done before, that things we would like to have done before.
Has there been any Star contact with the new Chinese owners, or has it been all done through Juan Gorlay and
all done through Juan Gorlay? We're trying to teach 6 or 7 of our board members Chinese, but we're not sure which dialects to go for at the moment. So we might be wasting our time with a lot of Mandarin and it's something else.
Maybe that's a work abroad trip needs to be taking place. The Star membership fees, buying one to Shanghai, one to Beijing, and then we'll go from there. Well, we'll crack on. It's interesting you mentioned incentives, because there's some incentives being discussed in the mailbag. Got a question on that this week, and we'll jump into that now.
Get social with the boys.
Find them on Twitter
at the Tarlhurst End
and facebook.com/thetarlhurstend.
So we mentioned earlier that there was a nice big Reading attendance at Stadium Alight on the weekend, and someone, Luke Jarrett, has emailed in to say, should there be more incentive for people to go to these long trips? So then, as Sunderland was the furthest trip of the season, I was thinking, why don't we get extra loyalty points for how far we have to travel from the Madstad? Could that be as simple as every 10 miles is an extra 2 points or something like that? Steve, is this a sort of thing that would A, encourage you to go further, or B, encourage other people to go further?
Well, I'm sure it would help things a little bit, but I'm not sure people would necessarily think about the loyalty points when they're planning how far they're going to travel. You know, if you're going to go up to Sunderland or Sheffield, you're not thinking, oh, I might get X amount of loyalty points. You're probably thinking, oh, it's going to take hours on the train. It's going to cost this much for a return. I'll probably have to book time off work, blah, 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 all this kind of thing. So it would be an incentive, but really it kind of comes down to ticket prices for me. You know, if it would be good to get extra points, but there's a lot more things in play than just loyalty points.
You know what this always reminds me of is I watched, the idea of loyalty points, it's nice. I'm sure certain people will be happy with it, but it just comes back to the idea of getting like bums on seats. And it comes back to an episode of that Channel 4 show, Undercover Boss, I think it was, like years and years ago, is the boss of Oceania Nightclub. And he went working in Oceania Nightclub, and he was working like the sales team, whatever it was. And they basically said that no matter what we do, we can offer all kinds of incentives to people, but the only incentive that works is cheap drinks. And at Reading Football Club, the only thing, and in football in general, the only thing that works is cheaper tickets and cheaper travel, which things the club don't even control.
Yeah.
So I just think with these sort of things, it can occasionally get a little bit gimmicky, obviously. That's not a serious suggestion, but at the same time, there's only one thing that I find works.
Well, two things. Successful team is the other thing, of course.
Yeah, which costs money.
Yeah. But to take up Luke's point specifically, that is too complicated an idea, and there'd be too much cheating, because all the people who'd got started in Blackpool or Chesterfield would be claiming extra miles from Reading and all that sort of thing. But he puts his finger on a genuine issue which we're really going to have to think about quite hard from next season, when iFollow for UK based supporters comes in, where you are going to be able to buy some kind of TV access or season ticket to watch home or away games that don't kick off at 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, as I understand that.
Yeah, the Tuesday midweek fixtures are effectively going to be up for grabs, broadcast it as you feel you can sort of thing. I don't know if it's Sky Sports or iFollow going to have first dibs, perhaps.
But Sky Sports will have first dibs, then anything else. 58, I think, of the 72 clubs are participating in this. So it's about half the Championship clubs, something like that. So there will be quite a few games where you can watch it more or less live on telly for, I don't know, £5 or £10 or whatever, or you can pay the £25, £38 plus the £20, £25 coach fare to go and see it live. Now, we can't do anything about free coach travel up there, but football clubs are going to have to think hard. If they want some sort of atmosphere in their grounds for midweek matches, they're going to have to get some away supporters there. And to get them there, they're going to have to start thinking about what prices they're charging them, and to do that they're going to have to break some of the regulations which will make them charge the away fans less than the home fans. So it's going to get quite complicated with all this TV coverage. Other thing you've got to bear in mind is more than half the Premier League games from the next TV deal will be televised live.
Yeah, because they're having a Saturday night 7:45 slot, I believe, that they're going to install for that.
Yeah.
But I think with the Premier League, you pretty much guarantee about 80% of the games are sold out. And as you say about Reading, you know, I think if you're playing Leeds at home on a Tuesday night, you can probably put that on TV. Aston Villa, Sheffield Wednesday, maybe, still going to get a lot of fans going. But Reading versus, you know, Doncaster Rovers on a Tuesday night, if you put that on TV, you're going to take a lot of fans out the stadium and not make up the cash to cover for that. But, you know, if anyone has any further points on this, then please feel free to get in touch, and we'll continue to discuss it, because I can tell you one thing for sure, it is not going to go away, as Roger was just sort of saying. Other question in the mailbag, there's only two this week, which is either we're doing something wrong, or the club are doing something right, or
the club are winning. We've had this problem for years.
As long as it's not me doing something wrong, then I'm happy. But yeah, always get in touch at thetarlesend@gmail.com or on Facebook or Twitter. We're always willing to have your mailbag questions. And Ben Venton has done just that. It says, regarding your previous week's discussion on whether the women's game would be as big as the men's game at any point, he doesn't think it would want to. Things like diving, commercialisation, inflated transfer fees have visibly had a detrimental effect on the men's game. Maybe women's football shouldn't ruin itself by becoming uncontrollable in the same way. Better they play it because it's enjoyable. Now, yeah, I think that's a perfectly fair point to have. Me and Wesley talked about last week, for anyone who missed it, the idea of how, you know, Facebook Live and those sort of added sort of little media things, kind of linked to what we were just talking about, have come up in the women's and the under 23 matches for Reading. And, you know, I think Ben makes a good point in the fact that maybe it just offers something different rather than trying to match the men's game. And he also says there's a new point that he wants to make. What do you think of fans leaving early from games? Now, pertinent point, given that we've just played Sunderland, and I'm pretty sure in my mind Sunderland fans have one of the worst reputations for this in all of English football. As he says, he saw it en masse on Saturday, but as a more general point, shouldn't love for a football club mean you see it through the bad times as well as the good? How do you think it makes the players feel when their fans depart just because they aren't winning? I know that people will try and explain it through leaving early to beat the rush. I could possibly understand this away from home, but these fans lived a stone's throw away. I would have the same response if our fans did this when we were losing at the Madstad. Steve, would you say that Reading fans are better or worse than your average fan across the country for leaving early?
I wouldn't. I think it's becoming more and more standard across all of football, across not even the UK, just the world. I think the general football is becoming more and more of a spectator thing. So I think more and more people are going to games and seeing it as a, I'm going to sit and watch and cheer when we score. I might join a few chants, it'll be fun. But they're not necessarily going to games to cheer their team on and really get involved and build up an atmosphere. I think a lot of fans around the world are going to sit, watch, see a few goals and then go home. They're not going, you know, people aren't. Some people will be. Not every fan will be going into the Madstad going, I'm going to roar this team on no matter what. I think a lot will turn up and go, oh, we've lost. Okay.
And when the result is done, that's the thing that matters, then they go home.
Yeah. And also, I think fans generally find it almost more enjoyable to have a whinge about something. So even when we're winning, I think fans will find a way to whinge about something or other because it's just easier to do and it's more... generates more debate, it's more outrageous and all this kind of thing. So people are more likely to whinge and moan than if things are going right. And we see it here on this podcast, don't we? You know, when things are going bad, people get in touch and have a whinge. And
I thought you were going to say I was whinging then. No.
But when things are going well, people are like, okay, cool, we won, great.
Yeah,
and then that's it. Nothing, you know, and I think it's a kind of similar thing with regards to stadium atmospheres and all that. People are turning up to spectate rather than necessarily... back the team.
I'd say that if you leave 3 minutes early, you might save yourself half an hour, three quarters of an hour on the journey home. And that's the kind of equation people are thinking about. The other thing I'd say is that people get to football much earlier than they used to. I think, you know, Elm Park days, you could leave home at 2 o'clock, 2:10, get to the ground, get home 5 o'clock, 5:05. It's, you know, half a day, if that. Whereas now, you spend a lot more time going to and from football, and that's what people are taking into account.
And perhaps out-of-town stadiums does that.
Yeah. Well, that is the thing, actually, because there are so many more ways of getting away from Elm Park quickly than there are from the car parks around the Medeski Stadium. Yeah.
I also think, you know, it does partly go back to the pitch kind of... if the team look like they're giving it a go and, you know, if the game's 2-1 and they're really going for an equaliser, then a lot more people are likely to stay. If it's 3-0 down, you've got the choice, like Roger said, you know, I could leave early and get home 30 minutes earlier, or I can stay and cheer on these good-for-nothing losers. And you know, it's kind of a thing lots of people do, and that all, again, kind of comes back to the attitude people have when... going to games nowadays.
And it kind of explains why Sunderland fans very rarely see the second half.
Yeah, I mean, why would they? They haven't won at home in over a year now, or almost a year.
It's almost become a game, isn't it?
It's kind of
how
like,
early can you leave and justify it?
Yeah, and it's almost like voting with your feet, you know.
Oh, yeah, it so, is the definition of voting with your feet, isn't it?
Like, you guys are letting me down. I'm wasting all my money on you, so why am I going to stay, you know? It's almost like you don't deserve me cheering you on because you haven't done anything to deserve it.
One thing the football marketing people have never been able to crack is how to keep people on at the stadium after the game. I remember at the Medeski Stadium, there were experiments serving, you know, lager in the North Stand bars after the game, and people just said, "No, why do I want to do that? You know, it's cold. Why do I want to drink, you know, horrible lager in a breeze block garage after the game?" So it's very difficult, very difficult. I wish there was a way for clubs to hold people back in an entertaining way with a kind of TV highlight show or here are the results or something like that. But no, most people just want to shoot.
It's also difficult to keep people behind because you haven't got that need to talk things through with your fellow fans anymore, because you can sit on the bus on the way home and you've got Twitter, you've got BBC Berkshire, or, you know, or you go elsewhere and Facebook and all that. There's just so many different ways of doing what you would do in a pub with people afterwards that you almost now, that's not really a thing that you crave necessarily, because you get it all from the comfort of your own home with your feet up.
Yeah, as what you said, it's cold at the stadium and we play in the winter, so maybe if it was a summer sport, maybe that would have a big impact on it. Well,
there are far too many middle-aged men with their tops off if that was the case.
Well, it's going to be cold next Monday night, I can guarantee you that, as we play Cardiff, and that is what we're going to be discussing as we end the show on Any Other Business.
The Tarlhurst Inn Podcast. Any Other Business.
The league leaders are coming to town on Monday, and it's not just the league leaders coming to town, the Sky TV cameras are coming as well, which means it's always a special occasion for Reading to get ignored, even when we're on TV. And Neil Warnock is also a bit of a special occasion when Neil Warnock comes to town. Something always kicks off. It's always something to talk about. And Cardiff, second in the league at the moment. They've taken a bit of a gap between with them and Wolves. Have really jumped clear in recent weeks. And I was wondering if you guys think that, you know, going into this game, it's basically the Wolves game we had a couple of weeks ago being rerun, isn't it, in terms of how we're going into it and how the opposition are going into it. So are we going to get beat 2-0 again, or is it finally going to be the time we take the points off a decent team?
We're scoring more goals nowadays, I think, so that's one thing in our favour. You know, if Kerr Morgan or however you say his name,
Jan,
is back. Jan, we'll go with Jan. If Jan is back, which, you know, he'll probably start and he'll be playing again, I think you'll have a lot more of a goal threat than we had in that Wolves game, especially with people like Barrow and Edwards scoring more recently. So we've got that in our favour. I don't know if it's a rerun. I can't tell what it's going to be like. I think I can't. Cardiff haven't been getting much airtime. That might just be me. And
they've been getting much less airtime than Wolves.
Yeah, so Wolves have been getting loads. Sheffield United, obviously the big story because they're doing so well after being promoted. So Cardiff, it says, sounds weird to say this of a team in second, but they're kind of flying under the radar a little bit. So it's an odd one.
They've been there since the start of the season, and I think they're 7 points behind Wolves at the moment. I don't think they're as good a team as Wolves, and we suffered. We lost an early goal to Wolves, did we? That game.
It's about 25 minutes in, I think it was. Yeah,
which made it really, really difficult because, you know, they were quite flying at the time. I think Cardiff lose the odd game every now and again.
Well, they've got the best defence in the league. They've only conceded 14 goals. But so, you know, that logic dictates that therefore their attack perhaps isn't as important. But then it's a Neil Warnock side. So I guess we needn't pontificate about how they're going to play because we know exactly how they're going to play, as any Warnock team over the last decade and a half has turned up to the Medeski and played.
With Sean Morrison to enjoy.
Oh, good.
Enjoys the word.
Yeah, enjoy. Yeah, I went to a Cardiff game a couple of years ago, and me and my friends brought some cereal. You know those mini boxes of cereal.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And we got checked by the bouncers or the doormen on the way in, and they were like, "Why have you got that?" It's like, Sean Morrison, he loves cereal.
It was trust us, he loves it.
Yeah, trust us, he loves cereal, all of it. Do you know what? I think this might be the kind of game where Cardiff, being second, will probably try and take the game to us, and Reading have it in their locker to play counter-attacking football, especially with the wing options we have. So I think there might be something in this game for Reading.
I think we need at least a draw to
keep
the momentum going. I think to lose to another top team after Middlesbrough, after Wolves, wouldn't be good.
Yeah, well, we'll have some predictions from you then, because the prediction league, I mean, I don't really want to discuss this because I've dropped off to the joint bottom now. Myself, Johnny Handbags and Westy all on 8 points on the prediction league, because Westy has pulled out his second result in a row, while Tom Crocker of the Wokingham Papers stormed into the lead on 12 points with Wim behind on 11. I don't know how to call this one, to be honest. I think I might just have to play it safe and go 1-1 again. What'd you say, Steve?
I'm going to go 2-1 to Reading.
You expect to see three goals in this game, team?
Maybe? I'm going for 2-2.
Four goals in this game.
Rough house game.
I also want to see Neil Warnock get in an argument and a fight with Yapstam, because we all know who'd win. Yap.
Okay.
Yeah. Just thought I'd clarify.
Any Cardiff fans listening, like, yeah, definitely Warnock.
Well, let's get Wally Downs to do golden goal.
Yeah.
It was a golden gamble at half time.
Definitely. Well, we had Stephen Hunt, and is it Ivar Ingemarsson turn up as well recently? Yeah. As well.
Stephen Hunt has weird hair nowadays.
He doesn't look like Stephen Hunt, does he?
No, he does not. He needs to get his shaggy hair back.
Yes, well, hopefully he should come on the podcast. Definitely get.
Yeah, get him back.
Yeah, get him back.
You'd need subtitles.
Back in Reading.
Yeah. Well, we missed our chance for that, actually. Yeah. So, yeah, that gives me something to do in the next week, because we've got a decent amount of time before the Cardiff game on the Monday night, so we can put our feet up over the weekend, not have to worry too much about the Championship results, because, to be honest, I don't really know who I'll be looking at to win or lose. It's that sort of stage of the season. Everything just happens and we'll have to assimilate ourselves into it. And that brings to an end this episode of the podcast. So thank you very much for coming down on this cold Monday night in Woodley. Thank you very much, Steve, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thank you indeed, Roger. Good luck with the signing on Monday.
Thank you very much.
And we will see you next time. And come on, your ass.
Your ass.
to find out what 150 is now. I want to find out what that word is.